I'm Ryan Warner, and this is Colorado Matters on KCFR. As a young boy growing up in Antonito in the San Luis Valley, Ruben Archuleta often heard stories about the penitentes. His grandfather and great-grandfather were both members of this secretive Catholic sect, best known for its acts of physical penance, including self-flagellation. But Archuleta says the penitentes have been misunderstood, and he's written a book to correct assumptions about them. It's called Land of the Penitentes, Land of Tradition. Ruben Archuleta spoke with Colorado Matters' Dan Dreher in 2003 when the book was first published.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Dan.
So you decided to write the book after coming across some diaries that had been kept in a trunk belonging to your grandmother. What were in those entries?
Well, they were in Spanish, you know, and I was never too interested in reading in Spanish. And I had seen them in that my grandmother's trunk for years and years, and finally I started reading them, and I really didn't, the interest didn't peak till I had this friend of mine drop by one time, a person by the name of Jim Perkins. He wrote a book called Tom Tobin, and he lived close to me, and we got to talking about some of the journals I had, and when he saw them, he says, could I borrow those journals and I could write a book about them? And I got to thinking, well, why don't I write a book about it? And that's the way I got started.
And what were in the entries that you were seeing?
There were two journals, and there were several prayer books called Cuaderno. The first journal was called La Morada del Centro, which is the Central Morada, and it was from the territory of New Mexico from the late 1800s. And this journal pretty much laid out the organizational chart, the positions of the penitentes, all their duties, also their initiation rites, and also the membership, the way they were supposed to act. The second journal was from the Morada de los Pinos. This is a morada in Los Pinos, Colorado. You know, it's in New Mexico, just south of the state line of Colorado. And this one had entries, journal entries from 1905 through 1925, and it was the minutes of their meetings, anything that they did while they were doing. While they were meeting, and it was awesome because this was such a secretive organization, and I actually had the handwritten journals.
Pretty amazing find, then.
It really was.
What's known about the origin of the penitentes?
There's several theories. Some of the scholars say they go back to about 1200 A.D., back to Europe when they had the self-flagellants, and the other theory is that they originated from the Third Order of St. Francis of Assisi, which is probably the most accepted theory, that these were Spanish Catholic laymen that formed this organization probably around the 1500s, you know, on through the 1800s, something like that. Mm-hmm. No real date set there. And what they did, and during the Mexican Revolution, the Franciscans had to leave, and the penitentes took over as far as carrying on the teachings of the church, helping with funerals, and helping the Catholic people there.
Why did they take root in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado?
Well, what happened is the conquistadors came up through from Spain to Mexico, and then they started spreading on towards northern New Mexico. And the penitentes were supposed to have been along with them about that time. Now, the priests were trying to convert the Native Americans and also trying to establish the Catholic religion there. So when there was a shortage of priests, the penitentes more or less took up the slack. What they did is they would help with the prayers, saying the rosaries, the Stations of the Cross, and then helping both the natives and also the Hispanic settlers there with both spiritually and also economically. So they pretty much went up to northern New Mexico and southern Colorado, and that's pretty much where they settled there.
Is it as simple as they found a place they liked to be in, an environment they liked to be in?
I think so. Mm-hmm. They were able to farm around there. They were able to raise sheep. A lot of them were sheep herders. My grandfather was a sheep herder. Mm-hmm. And several of the people that I've talked to that were involved with the penitentes, they were sheep herders.
In the book you write, the general opinion of the penitentes is that it is a religious order of Hispanic men who did nothing but beat themselves with whips and who crucified one of their members on a wooden cross.
Now, this was a very biased writing. I really got upset when I would read through some of his books. He was a preacher by the name of Alexander Darley. I think they called him the evangelist of the Southwest. But anyway, he didn't care much for the penitentes. He was trying to convert the Hispanic and Native population to the Protestant religion. So he didn't have much use for the penitentes because they were pretty competitive there. And also what happened is around the early 1900s, there was a person by the name of Carl Taylor that came from back east. He settled in New Mexico by Sandia Mountain. And he started writing about the penitentes. He was going to do an expose on the penitentes. Well, Carl Taylor got killed. And right away, this was a big conspiracy. Everybody was looking for conspiracies all over.
The secrecy of the order was leading to these kinds of rumors, I would suspect.
Yes, it was, because they couldn't get close to him. And naturally, the penitentes withdrew, you know, with all this scrutiny. So it turned out it wasn't really a conspiracy. It was Carl Taylor's house boy that killed him. And I think it was a robbery or something like that. But anyway, some of the news media got a hold of it. And they're going into all this conspiracy theories and things like that. And not only that, but there was a movie that was made in 1936 called Lash of the Penitentes. And it was really terrible, very biased.
Well, did they do these things? Did they hurt themselves as severely as the reports were circulating that they were?
They did. They were. It was corporal punishment, self punishment, the self flagellation. There were several exercises that they did, but people, I guess, they didn't quite understand why they were doing it. You know, they were not masochists. They did not enjoy hurting themselves or each other. What they did is they believed in penance, suffering in the exact same way that Jesus Christ suffered.
And just as Christ's blood was shed, they felt they had to shed their own blood.
Then when Christ was beaten with the whips, when Christ was crucified, when he had to carry the cross, when he had to wear the crown of thorns. And these are some of the exercises that the penitentes conduct during Holy Week, which is really representative of Christ's suffering.
And you point this out in the book, that it was only during Holy Week that they were carrying on these treatments, the self-flagellation and other things. The rest of the year, their practice wasn't as severe as it was during Holy Week.
No, they spent the rest of the year really helping each other, helping their families. But they also did conduct some discipline the rest of the year. Somebody got out of line. Mm-hmm. One story I was told by an old gentleman down, he was from New Mexico. He was probably in his 70s, but he told me that his father was an hermano mayor, an elder in the penitentes. And they had this one penitente that had a habit of, when he got drunk, he would beat his mother up. He lived with his mother. And they told him, you know, that is not acceptable behavior. So they warned him not to do it. It ceased for a while. Later on, the gentleman got drunk, and he beat his mother up again. So the hermano mayor and two other penitentes showed up, knocked on the door, took him out and tied him to a tree, and they whipped him good with whips. And I understand he never beat his mother up again.
Was there a crucifixion?
There were crucifixions, but they weren't actually nailed to the cross. They were lashed to the cross, and they were the cross was erected, and they were up there for an hour or two. And there were times, you know, that they would pass out. According to one of them, they did pass out. And then they would take them down. Now, my understanding is these crucifixions are still going on in the Philippines, where they actually do the nailing to the cross. But that's the only place that I've heard of. Now, I've been told by two different sources that these crucifixions and the physical exercises really ceased around World War II, about the time of World War II.
Give us a sense of what role the penitentes played in communities like Antonito, where you grew up.
As far as I was concerned, as far as I knew, they were very well respected, the gentlemen. They were Hispanic men, and what they did is, and you'll see this entry after entry in those journals from the Morada de los Pinos, is when somebody got sick, or if somebody got into trouble with the law, or somebody died, the penitentes would chip in. And mind you, I'm looking around 1907, and and they, you could always see them where they chipped in, you know, a dollar here, $2 there, $5, even as much as $7. And that's quite a large amount of money. There were also several entries in there where somebody wasn't able to pay. And what they would do is you could see entries where they donated their team of horses plus labor, or they would donate loads of wood. They would donate flour, and they would donate several days' labor, whether it was plowing or anything like that. But they did this all the time.
They were very civic-oriented then.
Very civic-oriented. Now, that was expected of them. You had to be an upstanding member of the community in order to become a penitente, and even a better member of the church. It was expected that you would abide by the church rules. You can read many instances where there's supposed to be conflict between the church and the penitentes. I found that most of the conflict occurred between the hierarchy and the church and the penitente organization, which would have probably been attributed to the bishops, Bishop Lamy from New Mexico, and then also the bishop, I think, is around 1833 from Mexico itself, and where they were trying to get the penitentes to stop this self-flagellation and physical punishment, things like that.
The larger Catholic Church was getting involved and attempted a condemnation of the Brotherhood at one point.
Yes, they did. In fact, I think at one time, it may have been Bishop Lamy that at one time required that you sign a paper that's saying you were not a penitente before you were allowed to receive the sacraments.
What was the church upset about?
They looked at these as cult happenings, evil happenings, and that they should not be doing this public disgrace in front of everybody. That, you know, this should not be conducted. It was uncivil. But when you came right down to it, like I said before, it was the hierarchy that was opposed to this. Now, the priests and the penitentes themselves got along good. They would help the priests to, you know, when they were conducting funerals, services, dig graves, anything like that, helping with the church. They got along good. I've located two photos where there's penitentes standing around a priest at their morales. So mm-hmm. the layman and the priest got along pretty good.
Tell us more about these meeting houses, the moradas that you've described.
Most of the moradas, the meeting places, were L-shaped. Most and all of them were made out of adobe. And the reason they were L-shaped is the main part of the hall where they held their services and rituals and things like that and their meetings was the main hall. And then off to the side would be the kitchen. The kitchen is where the their clothes would be washed by the women. Their meals were prepared by the women. The women could not belong to the penitentes.
Yeah, they were separated by gender.
Strictly mm-hmm. for men. But yet, the women were allowed to have auxiliaries. There was an auxiliary. They were called the Veronicas, and they went by several names, and where they would help the penitentes. They would also cook all the Lenten meals during Lent, which was the penitentes would be fasting during the whole week of Lent, and they could not eat any meat, so they would cook specific types of foods. The moradas had an altar on the back wall, and you would see this triangular-shaped candle holders. Most of them held 13 candles, which represented Jesus Christ at the top, and then the 12 apostles. And something I noted visiting these various moradas is their respect or almost worship of the Virgin Mary, the Mother God. You see a lot of statues of Mary. Mm-hmm. And same thing, they had great respect for women.
Our guest is author Ruben Archuleta. He's the former police chief of Pueblo and the author of Land of the Penitentes, Land of Tradition. Archuleta's grandfather and great-grandfather were both members of this secretive Catholic sect, which once thrived in small communities in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado. He spoke with Colorado Matters' Dan Dreher in 2003 when the book was first published. We'll take a short break. This is KCFR. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Ruben Archuleta, former chief of police of Pueblo. He's author of Land of the Penitentes, Land of Tradition. He spoke with Colorado Matters' Dan Dreher in 2003 when the book was first published.
You talked with several penitent brothers for your book. Were they reluctant to talk to you?
Yes, yes, they were. And when I first started putting this book together or talked about doing it, I was told, well, number one, you won't find very many penitenters because they're dying off, which was not true. They're still alive and well and very active. And then number two, the penitenters that I did talk to, I had to talk to them at length. They want to know what I was going to write, what I was going to say about the penitentes. And I told them about my concerns about the things that had been written about them, and I wanted to set the record straight. And two things really that really helped me, I was able to talk to them in Spanish, and also that my grandfather was a penitente. He was at Hermano Mayor, which gave me a little bit more credibility. And it took a while to really get to know these gentlemen. Several of these gentlemen were in there in the 80s. One of them will be 99 in April. And once we got to talking, they were very glad to talk to me to try to set the record straight. As far as revealing any secrets or anything that went on during their meetings, they did not reveal any because they were sworn to the oath of secrecy.
The Morada in your hometown, the meeting house in your hometown, is it still active?
It's still very active, and in fact, several of the pictures that I use of the encuentro, the procession there, I was allowed to take pictures there. In fact, I was allowed to take pictures inside the Morada. Normally, they wouldn't allow that. I was in Arroyo Seco down in New Mexico, and at the invitation of one of the hermanos, one of the 80-some-year-old penitentes, I had breakfast and coffee with them. I was given special permission to take pictures outside, but I wasn't allowed to take pictures inside, and I was not allowed to take pictures of the encuentro, the procession, even though it went from the Morada along the highway to the church on public property. They said I could not take pictures, and I respected their wishes.
Do you think that the secrecy is something that is important to retain for them? In other words, is it something that is necessary now?
I found that the secrecy is not as important, and in fact, it's eased off quite a bit. It was unheard of before to anybody for anybody to talk about the penitentes or to even allow somebody to look through their prayer books or anything like that. There's even a book that has been printed with all their prayers and their chants or hymns, whatever, in Spanish and in English. I have a copy of that. So the secrecy really isn't that necessary anymore. I think in the, and I'm talking about the early 1900s, it was probably their only way of survival because they were trying to, sensationalize everything that they were doing, and naturally they withdrew. But anymore, the attitude is so much different towards the penitentes. At one time, not many people like to admit that they had relatives in the penitentes. And since I've been doing these presentations, since I've written this book, I've accumulated more information now than I had before I wrote the book. And they're wanting me to include their moradas or their relatives. And they're seeing which angle I hit it from. It's one of respect and saying what exactly these people were doing. They were just ordinary citizens like anybody else.
Why do you suppose your grandfather and great-grandfather joined the penitentes?
Probably because it was expected of them. If your grandfather was a penitente, you know, your dad was supposed to be a penitente, and it just carried on from generation to generation. My father was not a penitente. I think he liked to party a little too much to be a penitente, but anyway, he was not one. I have been asked to join the penitentes, and I told them, and they said that you would be perfect for our cause to let people know exactly what we would do and things like that. And I told them, if I joined the penitentes, then I couldn't write about it. I would be, you know, sworn to the oath of secrecy. But the attitudes have really, really changed.
Was it a disappointment to your father's father or grandfather that he wasn't a penitente?
I'm sure it was, because it went from generation to generation. I never did know my great-grandfather. He was born in 1838. I knew my grandfather. He was born in 1883. And I can still see him, you know, as clear as day, you know, singing some of those alabados, the hymns at home, mm-hmm. and praying. And I remember very well when he died, when all they held a wake in my grandmother's house. My grandmother had an altar in her house, you know, and she had the candles and everything, and they held a wake in the house, and they sang all these eerie songs, and they did all the prayers, and they helped dig the grave and provided the food and everything that was expected of them.
While he was alive, you recount a memory of seeing your grandfather sitting on a bed while your grandmother tended to his wounds on his back. At the time, you didn't think much about that, but I guess in retrospect, it's obvious that he was self-flagellating.
That's you know, the more I never even thought about it, you know, when she was tending to his wounds, but also, you know, when I was going through the journals, there were things that I was missing in the journals. They kept talking about the seal, you know, but you weren't a real penitentiary till the seal was applied. And I was thinking, you know, it was like an armband or something they carry. Until I interviewed a former penitente that told me about all the rituals, which were very secretive. I was missing a lot. After I was given the descriptions of the rituals, the seal was where they cut you with a piece of glass, sharp glass on the back. Three times would have been the Ave Maria. And that's the seal that they were talking to. So, you know, there were things that you never even thought about, you know, like my grandfather, you know, having those wounds on his back. You know, I was a little kid and never even thought about it.
What do you think about that? In effect, it was this penance was what generated the rumors and the secrecy, you know, added fuel to that fire. What do you think about this regimen of self-abuse?
I don't think you'd find anybody nowadays that would want to go through it. I think you just had to be back in that time. That's the way you were brought up. That's the way you were. When I was a kid, you know, everything was almost like built on fear. You know, if you don't do this, the devil's going to get you, or God's going to punish you, and things like this. So, I mean, as a little kid, he lived in constant fear. So, you know, just like the picture in front of the book, the Carreta de la Muerte, the death cart with Doña Sebastiana there, you know, that is a very scary person, and which led to some of the people to believe that the penitentes worship death. They did not worship death. They worshiped living, but they were being reminded that they had to be prepared for death at all times. So it's just the way that you were brought up. You know, you accepted it. You were a penitente. You were going to go through this rituals. You were going to go through part of the same kind of suffering that Christ suffered.
If you just tuned in today, we're talking about a secretive Catholic sect from southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. Our guest is Ruben Archuleta, who's a former police chief in Pueblo and author of Land of the Penitentes, Land of Tradition. Did you have any qualms about writing about these rituals for your book?
Yes, I did. At one point, I was prepared to leave them out. Especially when I talked to one of the penitentes down in Fort Garland, when I showed him the illustrations that had been drawn by a friend of mine and the description of the rituals, and he said, "Where did you get that?" And I told him, "From a former hermano." And he said, "Oh, my gosh, you know, this is something that, you know, very few people have ever been exposed to." And I had some qualms about doing it, but, you know, I think once we get all this out in the open, and this is a part of their life, and this is reality, you know, once we get past that, we can go on to the real good that the penitentes were doing. It's scary.
Yeah, you were afraid that even talking about it again would generate more rumors about what the community is doing.
And I was probably more concerned about the penitentes themselves, you know, that I've violated their trust or what they would be thinking of me. But, you know, to date, I have gotten nothing but positive feedback.
You know, you say that possibly people today wouldn't put up with the kind of ritual that the penitentes were known for, and yet the the Moradas are still active, you say. So are we to assume that, that this kind of ritual remains in place?
I have been told by several sources that they no longer take place. And what was really funny is that same penitente, when I told him about the rituals that I had and showed him the drawings, he told me that those rituals had ceased about the time of during World War II, when the young men from northern New Mexico and southern Colorado were getting drafted. And when they're going through their physical, they're having to explain why they have all these scars on their back. And I think that's, they, you know, say, we're going to be going through this process, you know, we better not be doing that anymore. And I thought, well, maybe this guy's just trying to tell me they didn't do it, just to put me off, you know. But I ran across an article in a newspaper from Huerfano, El Huerfano down in Walsenburg, from 1941. And lo and behold, there's a story on this Danny, I think, his name, Benny or something like that. But it was a story about him where he got drafted, and he had to explain to the physicians, because they brought him, showing, look at all the scars this guy has. And he had to explain to them. And there he told the story about going through the rituals, and it explained it, and that was one of the reasons that they stopped doing this.
Was there a sense of shame about it?
No, it was just made him feel uneasy, because everybody's looking at him, you know, all the other GIs and the physicians. It just made him a little. I don't think they weren't ever ashamed of it. I think they were proud of those scars. And this one gentleman, the one that gave me the information on the exercises, he showed me his back, and he had several scars, not only three with the Ave Maria. He had several scars on his back, and I asked him, well, I thought you did this for initiation. And he says, yes, but during Holy Week, we can choose to go through it again. You can go everywhere from the Ave Maria with three cuts to the Ten Commandments, which I would assume was 10 cuts. But he had several scars on his back. I took most of the pictures in that book. I have a digital camera, and I try to take pictures of those scars on his back with and without a flash, and I could not get them to come out. Weird. It was really, really strange.
What do you think that means?
I better get a better camera.
I am curious, how many penitentes would you say are active today?
I would say over 1,000, if not. And the reason I'm saying this, because one of the gentlemen that I interviewed, he gave me a roster, not the actual names, but the numbers that attended a conference down in Santa Fe several years ago, maybe about 5 years ago or so. But there were over 700 penitentes that attended that conference in Santa Fe from 72 different communities. And so they're still alive and well. At one time, there had to be maybe over 100 Moradas down in New Mexico, and probably 3 or 4 dozen in Colorado, including one here in Denver.
Well, have you heard from any of the penitentes that you spoke with about their reaction to your book?
They really liked it. In fact, I had to give one of them an extra copy to take down to New Mexico, because they wanted a copy of it. And it got to the point where this one gentleman that I interviewed, he gave me one of his prayer books, one of the cuadernos, that had the Stations of the Cross that belonged to his father, and they were barely readable. And he wanted to know if I could put a book together for him on the Stations of the Cross, which I did. I've kept in contact with every one of them. Now, naturally, you know, some of them, like I say, they're in their 80s. The 98-year-old gentleman is in the hospital right now, not in the best of health, and one of the other ones is not in the best of health. But I got some really nice notes from them saying they appreciated what I did. I got a really funny letter from a gentleman. He was from down south, because I took the time to give him a call. He had a southern accent. And he says, he started the letter saying, I'm not a Catholic, I'm not a penitente, I'm a gringo. But he says, I read your book, and I really appreciate what you did for the penitentes. Finally told the real story. And I think that's why the penitentes really appreciate it. So really, really positive. Nothing negative. I was really leery, especially after putting, you know, the physical exercises in there. I was really concerned about that. And like I said, you know, they're coming out of the woodwork. I had one lady that ran across me at Lowe's, and she chewed me out because I didn't include the little town of Garcia, because there's a morada there. Why didn't I go talk to her mother, you know? I mean, there's hundreds of moradas, but they're coming out from all over. I've accumulated rosters from towns in New Mexico that don't even exist anymore with the names. And same thing. And again, you know, these people, they want to see the names of their relatives in there. Before, you know, they wouldn't let too many people know that they were penitentes. But now, like, there's a certain pride, you know, hey, you know, my grandfather was a penitente, and I get that all the time. And it's really so nice to see someone like that.
Thank you for talking to us today.
I really enjoyed it, Dan.
Ruben Archuleta is author of Land of the Penitentes, Land of Tradition. He spoke with Colorado Matters' Dan Dreher in 2003, when the book was first published.